This is the third day of this January 2019 Rohatsu 7-Day Sesshin. And in keeping with the theme of Buddha's enlightenment, or enlightenment generally, I'm going to turn to the great Hakuin this morning. We haven't been reading all that much from the works of Hakuin in recent years, and yet we chant this, we recite this this Hakuin chant, the chant in praise of Zazen, before every Teisho. Many people know it by heart, and yet same people know little about Hakuin. I'm not going to get into any of his lengthy letters or other works, but just turn to his enlightenment. Plural, enlightenments. Just briefly, he had this experience when he was very young. His mother was bathing him, and he had just heard in the local village, he had heard about the fires of hell. Some Buddhist priest was reading from this popular idea of hell and the many kinds of hell, and it really just scared the daylights out of Hakuin. He went into a great panic in the bath. His mother ordered the maid to stoke up the fire, get the bath warmer, and suddenly he kind of freaked out over that. He says, gradually my skin began to prickle with the heat, and the iron bath cauldron began to rumble. Suddenly I recalled the descriptions of the hells that I had heard, and I let out a cry of terror that resounded through the neighborhood. this book is called The Zen Master Hakuin by Philip Yampolsky. This is one of the few books in English that were available in the early years of the Zen Center. Roshi Kaplow would turn to this book every third or fourth sesshin, because there were so few that were in English that could be commented on. From this time on, I determined to myself that I would leave home to become a monk. Well, his parents would not consent to this, and yet he went frequently to the temple to recite sutras and study the works of Confucianism. This you find very often in the biographies of the Zen masters, how they started out in their youth studying the classics, the Confucian classics. At 15, I left home to become a monk, and at that time I vowed to myself, even if I should die, I will not cease my efforts to gain the power of one whom fire will not burn and water will not drown. Day and night I recited the sutras and bowed to the Buddhas, but I noticed that when I was ill or taking acupuncture or moxa treatment, the pain I felt was just as it had been before. I was greatly depressed and said to myself, I became a monk against my parents' wishes and have yet to make the slightest progress. It seems from his own autobiographical account of his, that he was subject to depression in his early years, at least. It was later years, it seems to have been more mania, as we'll hear. When I was 19, I happened to read there's a long Chinese title, which is the translator tells us, is a collection of 74 biographies of famous monks. So he read this collection of biographies, and it included the story of how Master Yantao, it's Ganto in Japanese, was killed by bandits, and how his cries at the time resounded for over 3 li. It's a mile and a half, I think. It's a very famous story about the great Ganto, who figures in several koans, having been run through with the sword of a bandit, and how he cried out at the time. And this became quite a problem for the young Hakuin. I wondered why such an enlightened monk was unable to escape the swords of thieves. If such a thing could happen to one who was like a unicorn or a phoenix among monks, a dragon in the sea of Buddhism, how was I to escape the staves of the demons of hell after I died? What use was there in studying Zen? What a fraud, Buddhism. Here again, the fear of hell that drove him in his youth. How I regretted that I had cast myself into this band of strange and evil men. Anyone who's read or heard Hakuin, there's a lot of hyperbole in his writing. He was is no more colorful, vivid, dramatic writer than Hakuin among the masters. So a lot of what he says you can take with a little grain of salt. This band of strange and evil men, what was I to do now? So great was my distress that for 3 days I could not eat, and for a long time my faith in Buddhism was completely lost. Statues of the Buddha and the sacred sutras looked like mud and dirt to me. It seemed much better to read lay works, to amuse myself with poetry and prose, and thus to a small degree to alleviate my distress. Again, there are those who surmise that this was a real clinical depression he went through. And he seems to have really turned away from the Dharma for several years. He's describing at age 19, and then he picks it up again at the age of 22. Amuse myself with poetry and prose. I think of all the ways that people these days can amuse themselves and not to have to face the great matter. Just YouTube videos alone could keep you busy with all your free time, much less everything else that's online. And then when I was 22, I went to the province of Wakasa, and while attending lectures on the Shu Dong Lu, I gained an awakening. Later, when I was in the province of Iyo, I read such and such and achieved an intense awakening. I concentrated night and day on the Mu Koan without a moment's rest, but to my great disappointment, I was unable to achieve a pure and uninvolved state of undistracted meditation. Equally disappointing to me was the fact that I could not achieve the state where walking and sleeping are the same. Now, we have to raise the question, what he means by awakening. He had he had one, again, an awakening in a certain place, and then in another place he achieved an intense awakening, and yet he says, I was unable to achieve a pure and uninvolved state of undistracted meditation. We just don't know what he meant, what he means by a state of awakening. And the word can be ambiguous, and even today, as it's tossed around in different Buddhist schools. Even after a first breakthrough, it is not at all easy to achieve what he calls a pure and uninvolved state of undistracted meditation. You see throughout his recounting of his spiritual journey, the tremendous aspiration he had, tremendous aspiration. He had raised the bar so high that no matter what experiences he had for years and years, they weren't enough. They weren't satisfying to him. And this is what is part of what is so great about Hakuin. He wouldn't settle for some lesser insight. And this reflects a tremendous faith in himself. He knew what he is capable of, what we're all capable of. He had this profound faith in his original nature, and anything less than realizing it became almost unbearable to him. The spring of my 24th year found me in the monks' quarters of such and such place, pursuing my strenuous practice. Night and day I did not sleep. I forgot both to eat and rest. Suddenly a great doubt manifested itself before me. Again, doubt here means perplexity. It doesn't mean skepticism. It means questioning, the doubt sensation. It was as though I were frozen solid in the midst of an ice sheet extending tens of thousands of miles. A purity filled my breast, and I could neither go forward nor retreat. To all intents and purposes, I was out of my mind, and the Mu alone remained. Although I sat in the lecture hall and listened to the master's teisho, it was as though I were hearing a discussion from a distance outside the hall. At times it felt as though I were floating through the air. Again, he's describing some features of certain kind of samadhi, where our sense experiences recede, and everything is more distant. Everything in the world is more distant. He goes on, this state lasted for several days. Then I chanced to hear the sound of the temple bell, and I was suddenly transformed. It was as if a sheet of ice had been smashed, or a jade tower had fallen with a crash. Suddenly I returned to my senses. I felt then that I had achieved the status of Yen Tao, Ganto, the one who was run through with a sword, who through the three periods of time encountered not the slightest loss, although he had been murdered by bandits. He felt he achieved the status of this great Ganto, and who now he recognized had encountered not the slightest loss, even after being murdered. Saw it in a whole new way now. All my former doubts vanished as though ice had melted away. Here now he's talking about doubts as skepticism. In a loud voice I called, "Wonderful, wonderful! There is no cycle of birth and death through which one must pass. There is no enlightenment one must seek. The 1,700 koans handed down from the past have not the slightest value whatsoever." My pride soared up like a majestic mountain. My arrogance surged forward like the tide. Smugly, I thought to myself, in the past 200 or 300 years, no one could have accomplished such a marvelous breakthrough as this. Well, as we'll hear, pride goeth before a fall, in his case, literally a fall, as we'll hear. This one short sentence, "Suddenly I returned to my senses." So this is how it can be in a samadhi or even a samadhi-like state, where there is an altered state, and one can feel not oneself at all, and obviously a strange mental condition as such as he describes, but it's a temporary thing. When one breaks through that, then on the other side, one's senses are more alive than ever. One is more effective and functional, responsive and alive than ever before. It's a kind of a tunnel. It's a tunnel one goes through, this samadhi state. And there's no guarantee that when you enter that tunnel that you'll find your way out of it in any given sesshin, say. Sometimes people just rest in that state of absorption. And it won't necessarily open up into awakening. Can be very seductive to linger in that state, because really it's as though nothing matters. None of our concerns, our anxieties are operating, and it's a state of just indescribable peace and rest. And again, it takes such tremendous aspiration to not settle for that, to have to break through it, get beyond it. So here he is, swaggering around, thinking that he has achieved a greater enlightenment than anyone in centuries. And then he says, "Shouldering my glorious enlightenment, I set out at once for Shinano." And then he called on this master Shoju, who was very, probably the single most important teacher to Hakuin. And he told him of his experience and presented him with a verse. This was common in Japan, as it was in China, or more so probably in China, where you would present a verse showing your understanding as a result of your awakening. He says, "The master, holding my verse up in his left hand, said to me, 'This verse is what you have learned from study. Now show me what your intuition has to say.' And he held out his right hand. I replied, 'If there were something intuitive that I could show you, I'd vomit it out.' And I made a gagging sound." The master said, "How do you understand Zhao Zhou's Mu?" I replied, "What sort of place does Mu have that one can attach arms and legs to it?" The master twisted my nose with his fingers and said, "Here's some place to attach arms and legs." I was nonplussed, and the master gave a hearty laugh. "You poor hole-dwelling devil," he cried. I paid him no attention, and he continued, Do you think somehow that you have sufficient understanding? You see, Hakuin here is taking these blows with a lot of resilience. He's not just crawling away humbled. Such is his state of mind. Do you think somehow that you have sufficient understanding? I answered, what do you think is missing? Then the master began to discuss the koan that tells of Nan Xuan's death. I clapped my hands over my ears and started out of the room. What a handful he must have been. The master called after me, hey, monk. And when I turned to him, he added, you poor hole-dwelling devil. From then on, almost every time he saw me, the master called me a poor hole-dwelling devil. You can be sure that this Shoju, his master at the time, saw the incomparable potential of this swaggering young monk and knew that he had to push him to the limit. One evening, the master sat cooling himself on the veranda. Again, I brought him a verse I had written. Delusions and fancies, the master said. I shouted his words back at him in a loud voice, whereupon the master seized me and rained 20 or 30 blows with his fists on me and then pushed me off the veranda. Now, this it was after a long spell of rain, and he says, I lay stretched out in the mud as though dead, scarcely breathing and almost unconscious. I could not move. Meanwhile, the master sat on the veranda roaring with laughter. After a short while, I regained consciousness, got up, and bowed to the master. My body was bathed in perspiration. The master called out to me in a loud voice, you poor hole-dwelling devil. Okay, he gave Hakuin the right medicine, because then now Hakuin says, after this, I devoted myself to an intensive study of the koan on the death of Nan Xuan, not pausing to sleep or eat. One day I had a kind of awakening and went to the master's room to test my understanding, but he would not approve it. All he did was call me poor hole-dwelling devil. I began to think that I'd better leave and go somewhere else. One day when I had gone to town to beg for food, I encountered a madman who tried to beat me with a broom. This guy met his match with Hakuin. Unexpectedly, I found that I had penetrated the koan on the death of Nan Xuan. Then the other koans that had puzzled me fell into place of themselves, and I penetrated them all. After our return to the temple, I spoke of the understanding I had gained. This time the master neither approved nor denied what I said, but only laughed pleasantly. But from this time on, he stopped calling me a poor hole-dwelling devil. Later, I experienced enlightenment two or three times, accompanied by a great feeling of joy. At times there are words to express such experiences, but to my regret, at other times, there are none. It was as though I were walking about in the shadow cast by a lantern. Then he returned to attend on his first teacher, who had fallen ill. This is what is so remarkable about the Hakuin and his story, is the number of awakening experiences that he had. According to some other source, he said he had three major enlightenments and some 18 lesser ones. One day, I read the following passage. As we go to part, a tall bamboo stands by the gate. Its leaves stir the clear breeze for you in farewell. I was overcome with a great joy, as though a dark path had suddenly been illuminated. Unconsciously, I cried aloud, "Today, for the first time, I have entered into the samadhi of words." I arose and bowed in reverence. After this, I set out on a pilgrimage. One day, when I was passing through southern Ise, I ran into a downpour, and the waters reached to my knees. Suddenly, I gained an even deeper understanding of the verse on the roundness of the lotus leaf by Da Wei. I was unable to contain my joy. I lost all awareness of my body, fell headlong into the waters, and forgot completely to get up again. My bundles and clothing were soaked through. Fortunately, a passerby, seeing my predicament, helped me to get up. I roared with laughter, and everyone there thought I was mad. That winter, when I was sitting at night in the monk's hall, I gained an enlightenment from the sound of snow falling. The sound of snow falling. The next year, while practicing walking meditation, notice that walking meditation at the monk's hall, I suddenly had an enlightenment experience greater than any I had had before, and was overcome by a great surge of joy. He describes a dream he had, that I'm going to skip that. Then he says, later I happened to read the Blue Cliff record again, and this is a big collection of koans, and my understanding of it differed completely from what it had been before. And then he says, I wish that everyone would realize that studying Zen under a teacher, that means practicing. I don't know why translators so often refer to this tremendous training they go through as study. Maybe it's a literal translation, but it can't be what these guys really go through. It's training. I wish that everyone would realize that training Zen under a teacher is not such a simple matter after all. Although I am old and dissipated and have nothing of which I can be proud, I am aware that at least I have not spent 40 years in vain. Was it not for this reason that Chang Wu let go of his gold and engaged in his painful struggles toward success? As in the example I gave you, if you shoulder the one-sided understanding you have gained and spend your whole life vainly polishing and purifying it, how are you any different from Chang Lu, who guarded his piece of gold throughout his life, starving himself and bringing only harm to his body? Don't know anything more about this Chang Lu, but I think we've learned enough just from reading this, someone who hoarded his gold to such an extent that he suffered. That's another just remarkable thing about Hakuin and the great masters is how they wouldn't settle for anything, just kept discarding whatever experiences they'd had, just leaving them behind, not savoring them, certainly not boasting about them, but just moving on, always moving on. This is one of the great emphases in Zen, is to never look back at what you, any success you've had, any insight, because there's always further to go. Each time, with each insight we have, we can imagine it to be some kind of crowning experience. But then as time goes by, we see there's still a lot of work to do. In India, such a person, referring to this Chang Wu, who was hoarded his gold, is called a poor son of a rich man, a follower of the two vehicles. In China, he is spoken of as belonging to the group that practices the heretical silent illumination Zen. Yeah, and a footnote here, Hakuin often disparaged what he called silent illumination, practitioners of silent illumination, which is very similar to Shikantaza. I'm sure what he really means is those who practice it the wrong way, who are just allowing themselves to drift in their thoughts, settle into a complacency, which is especially easy to do with Shikantaza. Real Shikantaza, or silent illumination, is the most demanding of all the Zen practices, the summit of Zen practices. I never even attempted it till I'd been sitting for 15 years. As far as I can tell, all these great masters of the Tang Dynasty, Choshu, Umon, Deshan, these great ones that we so often read from, they were all doing Shikantaza. But they were doing Shikantaza. They weren't just sifting through their thoughts. What Hakuin is emphasizing is the danger of settling into just a quiet state and letting that be one's limit. None of these knows the dignity of the Bodhisattva, nor does he reach the understanding that illuminates the cause for entrance to a Buddha land. Nowadays, people go about carrying on their shoulders a single empty principle, and with it, quote, he's quoting these guys, understand the Buddha, understand the patriarchs, understand the old koans. Then they all say, like the stick, like the dharani, like the kotsu. Now, I've never run across this sentence before, but the translator, Jan Polsky, says this passage is unclear. Presumably these people who bear a single empty principle on their shoulders and claim to understand the Buddha, patriarchs, and koans equate the stick with the Buddha, the dharani with the koans, and the shout, that's the kotsu, with the patriarchs. How laughable this is. Exert yourself, students, for the Buddha way is deep and far. Let everyone know that the farther you enter the sea, the deeper it becomes, and the higher you climb a mountain, the taller it gets. Or the other way I've heard it is, the taller you get on the mountain, the more you can see. Well, we are nearly at the end of our time, so let's stop now and recite the four vows. All beings without number,
I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain.